This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
And let's see, overnight lows around 46. Breezy though, Tuesday night, tomorrow night, expect south winds 7 to 12 miles an hour. Amping up to 21 to 26 by evening. Gusts could hit 38 miles per hour tomorrow night. That's something. Alternative forecast, we don't have that today because it's holding pretty much steady. And now we're going to news from around Cascadia. We are first up. We have this. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife accidentally, right, released at least 250 hatchery juvenile spring chinook into the Bull Run River. This against a federal court agreement when an so-called a properly installed screen on an acclimation pond tour. The Native Fish Society this week on Wednesday is asking a federal federal judge to stop Oregon's seasonal release of juvenile salmon and steelhead into the Sandy River. This is somewhat of a precedent. This sets a precedent. Here to talk about it with us this morning is Mike Moody, the director, the head of the Native Fish Society. Good morning, Mike. We're very happy to have you with us. Good morning.
Chris?
Yes, good morning.
Yep, good morning. I'm glad to be with you.
Thank you so much for joining us today. This ruling comes before the results of a massive lawsuit, a significant lawsuit that the Native Fish Society has launched. Can you talk a little bit about what happened, this accident? When we learn of these sort of accidents, it is naturally suspicious minds would say, well, you know, there have been efforts to claim that the hatchery fish are exactly the same as wild fish, and this is been proven. Science would suggest otherwise. The ruling on Wednesday, can you talk a bit about that and then what that leads up to?
Sure, I'd be glad to. We have filed a preliminary injunction with the court, asking the court to suspend this year's hatchery releases in the Sandy River. We have as you pointed out, a lawsuit filed in federal court that is slowly moving through the system, and we are on Wednesday asking the court to suspend hatchery releases this year until the outcome of the lawsuit has been settled. That's all this refers to.
But now can talk a little bit about what this actually means. Why is this of concern, release? And for that matter, once hatchery fish are released, there's certainly no calling them back. And one wonders if release such as this is done to prove a point releasing hatchery fish into wild stocks has no effect. I cannot help but ask.
Well, I read of the accidental release this morning as it sounds as if you did. So I really don't know much about it. I have to take them at their word that it was an accident. It sounds like there was a part of their equipment failed, and it certainly sounds like they were fairly quick to get it fixed. The big issue here is frankly the science of hatchery fish versus wild fish, and that is at the heart of our lawsuit. The Marmot Dam was removed basically at the request of the public, not by fishing groups, not by conservation groups. It was removed at the insistence of the public. And to date, the public has spent upwards of $120 million to restore habitat throughout that entire watershed. And the intent here is to recover wild fish. Those funds have been spent by Portland General Electric, by the City of Portland, federal agencies, and maybe more importantly, by the citizens of Oregon. Interestingly, Chris, more than 85% of Oregonians don't fish, and yet they are paying for this expenditure not only in the form of their power bills, but also in the form of taxes that we all pay. So that, I think, has not sort of been conveyed certainly enough times that everyone is paying for that. I might also point out that the public is paying for the legal defense bills of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife and for the National Marine Fisheries Services. The evidence is both anecdotally and peer-reviewed science is growing, and it is near overwhelming. And that is that hatchery fish are deleterious to wild fish. They compete for rearing ground. They compete for food. And when they interbreed, that species becomes continually weaker and weaker and weaker. They lose what is known as performance, which means their reproductive fitness goes down, and their survival fitness goes down as well.
And that is exactly what we're faced with. Thank you. I want to thank so much. We're out of time for today. Love to have you back and talk a bit more about this. It's quite clear to that people do not understand what's at stake here, and some of the decisions might want to be revisited. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Mike Moody's been my guest. He's head of the Native Fish Society, and so this is something to watch very carefully, because it's not just the fish, the life of fish in our rivers has bearing on the ecosystem up, down, and all the way through the chain. So thanks so much for that, Mike. We're going to go now. We've got CRC news and other news, the warming of the Columbia River from around Cascadia. But right now we have Matt Zimmerman on the line. He's with the Electronic Frontier Foundation. He's on the line right now to talk about something that has concerned many listeners, many among the KBOO community, both for personal reasons and political reasons. And the national security letters, which have been one of the grim, odious products of the USA Patriot Act. And good morning, Matt. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Well, thanks largely, and I believe completely, thanks to the Electronic Frontier Foundation, a federal judge ordered the FBI to stop issuing spying orders, these national security letters, which forced companies to disclose customer data, at the same time, of course, censoring them from discussing the order with the press and the public. Before we talk about what the implications of this ruling are, do you want to talk a bit about these national security letters and their genesis and the fear mongering that the USA Patriot Act has sold to us?
Sure. The national security letters actually came into being even before the Patriot Act. They originally passed in the mid 80s, and the idea was to give the FBI the ability to, when they were originally passed, as a tool to investigate counterterrorism suspects. The FBI would be allowed to go to banks and phone companies to be able to get subscriber records about spies, essentially.
Well, excuse me, I did misspeak. The USA Patriot did, in the aftermath of all this, did amp up the misuse and the punitive use of these instruments of fear. Excuse me for that.
No, absolutely, the Patriot Act certainly expanded the scope and the problem with these with national security letters. I mean, there were problems before, but Patriot dramatically expanded whose records could be sought. So it expanded beyond spies to allow the FBI to obtain records that they simply decided were relevant to a national security investigation. So that expanded it from, again, spies to potentially anyone in the country who the FBI said might have relevant information about a national security investigation. And again, the gag order was extended as well. So telecommunications companies, for example, who received these orders were now being asked for records about Americans, in a much broader way than before, and they were again being told that they could never share that they had even received these requests. And not surprisingly, the use of NSLs went up dramatically after Patriot. The year before, the FBI issued about 8,500, and the year after, they issued I think over 50,000. So it really caused great concern for us and many others.
So how do you find out what they know about people? I mean, freedom of information requests in some cases can be denied or redacted to the point of being useless. How do you go about finding what they know, so to speak?
Well, we owe a lot of thanks to a gentleman by the name of Nick Merrill. In the mid-2000s, the ACLU brought a challenge on behalf of Mr. Merrill, who was at the time running a small ISP in New York, and he received one of these letters. And notwithstanding the fact there was a gag provision, he said that there's simply something wrong with this. This can't be right. This can't be constitutional that the FBI can obtain these kinds of records. So he challenged the statute. The ACLU was very successful with certain aspects of the litigation. And in response, Congress ordered that the FBI, that there be an Office of Inspector General investigation into the use of national security letters. And so we know from that report that the FBI has misused this power, not surprisingly, using it to investigate people and in situations that weren't authorized. We know the numbers of NSLs that were issued during that time, and the FBI releases a very limited amount of information currently about its use of NSLs, such as the aggregate number of NSLs. But we don't really know the full extent, certainly, of what information is being sought, and that's part of the problem, that the FBI is deciding behind closed doors who gets investigated, doesn't tell anyone, and ostensibly Congress plays some oversight role, but that oversight role has been questionable at best.
Well, I want to thank you so much for that. I do have other questions, and I would like to invite you back. I'd love to know what happened if the government, will obviously file an appeal. And the EFF is not going to let go. And I'm wondering about what's happening. I'd like to invite you back. We are out of time for today, however. I've been speaking with Matt Zimmerman with the Electronic Frontier Foundation, who has managed to score major victories so far as our civil liberties are concerned. And we'll put a link to that website on the KBOO website so listeners can follow up on that. Just a brief note that the European Union has come up with some money for Palestine. This has been Cascadia for March 18th. Kathleen Stevenson engineered the show today. She's also, of course, the AM News and Public Affairs Director. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
This KABU program is made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. A few days ago, as I returned home, I was greeted by four crows perched on the telephone wires in front of my house. They were all watching me in a curious manner. I took it as a sign that they knew that John Maslov is returning to Locus Focus this morning for another animated discussion about these extremely smart birds whose highly developed social skills mirror those of humans. This morning, we'll learn about our uniquely symbiotic relationship with crows as we find out what goes on in a crow's brain that makes them such fascinating creatures. John Maslov is a professor of wildlife science at the University of Washington School of Environmental and Forest Sciences and the author of Gifts of the Crow, now out in paperback, which takes us on a tour of the corvid brain from perspectives of biology, chemistry, and whimsy. John, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thank you, Barbara. Great to be here.
And it's good to have you back. I understand you've been doing a bit of traveling around Portland talking about crows and getting interviewed by the Oregonian and a number of other things.
Well, I did spend some time in Portland. Yeah, it was great with Audubon, and also there was a nice conference down there from wildlife rehabbers. So it was great to talk with them and get some of their insights as well about the corvids that they take care of.
Well, I'm not sure how much of it has to do with your book or if it's just something cosmic happening, but it seems like there's a great deal of interest in crows. It's ever-growing, as is the crow population in Portland. So maybe they have something to do with each other.
Yeah, I think, and, you know, again, this is a bird that people interact with in so many ways. It's a very familiar animal, so that just brings up these sorts of interactions and realizations that they're there and that they're influencing us.
Well, I was thinking as I was greeted by the crows the day when I was coming home, how we often think of crows as harbingers and not always of good things. And I was thinking that if I hadn't read your book, those crows that were waiting for me would have made me nervous. But instead, I was very intrigued by them and tried to figure out what they were trying to tell me. Why is it that we find crows threatening and fascinating at the same time?
Well, I think the threatening part is just a long-standing culture that we've had as humans with these animals. They've been around.